This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
No one personifies this belief more than Naomi Klein, a longtime ally to both of our institutions. An unwavering commitment to truth-telling has defined Naomi's career. The New York Times called 1999's No Logo a movement Bible of the anti-corporate globalization movement. In fact, Nike was so threatened by Naomi's critique that they offered a detailed point-by-point response to the book. But people had already heard Klein's cry. No Logo was an international bestseller, selling over 1 million copies in over 28 languages. But Naomi didn't stop there. The shock doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, her dissection of the failures of the neoliberal system was published in 30 languages and also has over a million copies in print. The Occupy Wall Street movement adopted it and brought her words into action. Her latest book, This Changes Everything, has been another game changer. Naomi's eloquent, frantic call to environmental action and a new kind of community building was heard at even the highest international levels. And she was recently invited to speak both at the Vatican and act as a climate change consultant to Pope Francis. It's really special that she's here tonight to celebrate the paperback release of This Changes Everything on a day that, perhaps, groundbreaking environmental regulations have been put on the table. As Naomi tweeted this week, there is a lot to discuss. Please help me welcome Naomi Klein. Thanks.
Wonderful introduction, and it's, I for one am very excited by the Busboys and Politics and Prose collaboration. I used to feel very torn about having to choose. Now we don't have to choose. It's so great. Okay, something's wrong with that. I'm timing myself. I'm not texting or tweeting. I'm making sure that I stay on topic and on time. So, hi everybody out there too.
Hi.
I feel very separated from you, but it's nice to be able to see you. This is a big day in climate news, and this is a kind of wonky city, so I'm assuming that there are people here who actually want to talk about Obama's climate plan announced today. So let me just get that out of the way a little bit. Because, you know, on the one hand, we have Republicans saying that it's economic apocalypse, and on the other side, we've got Democrats saying this is, you know, historic, it's going to change everything, it's what we've been waiting for. And the truth is, I think that there is a huge amount of hyperbole on both sides. It's definitely not economic apocalypse. It's not going to destroy the economy. It will probably have, you know, barely noticeable changes. So in a way, directly regulating coal-fired power plants is historic, but only because the historical record is so poor. I mean, it's so little has been done that, yes, in comparison to that, this really is something. In comparison to nothing, something is something. What it is not is a science-based climate action plan. It is not in line with what the overwhelming majority of climate scientists are telling us we need to do if we are to stay within our carbon budget for a 2-degree temperature target. Now, 2 degrees is what our governments agreed to, including the Obama administration, in Copenhagen in 2009. So that, at the time, was an incredibly controversial target. And many scientists believe that that is much too high, but that is what our governments agreed to do when they went to Copenhagen in 2009. They said, we will allow temperatures to increase by 2 degrees Celsius and no more, because anything above that is too dangerous. Now, when that happened, the small island nations came together and said that this was a death sentence, that they needed 1.5 to survive. The African delegates, when the news came out that 2 degrees was going to be the temperature target, walked out en masse from all the sessions they were in and marched through the hallways of this huge convention center in Copenhagen and said that it was a genocide for Africa. And so I say this because we are actually on target for 4 degrees of warming if we stay on the road we're on. The other thing that we hear about this announcement is that, so don't be so critical because it's a step in the right direction. And it is a step in the right direction. And if it were 2009, if Obama had just taken office, I would be the first to say, absolutely, this is a step in the right direction. Let's follow it up with a bold carbon tax. Let's follow it up with a feed-in tariff on the German model. Let's follow it up by banning new oil and gas leases on public lands. Let's follow it up with a bold investment in public transit that are going to create huge numbers of jobs and reduce commute times for low-income people. Let's lay out this plan. But we're not in 2009. And at the same time as we take this step in the right direction, we're simultaneously stepping in the wrong direction in lots of other ways. This administration has overseen opening up huge parts of this country to fracking. It has laid more oil and gas pipeline than any administration in history. And just this Thursday, drilling began in the Arctic for the first time, exploratory drilling. So if you take one step in the right direction and five steps in the wrong direction, you're going in the wrong direction, okay? And I understand that when this administration is under such, completely insane attack from the right, there is the urge to defend these steps. But the impetus for this transition is science, that we need to be bounded by what science is telling us. So, we can't claim that this plan is science-based when it's not. But at the same time, we need to build on it. And I think it does show that there is appetite and support for bold climate action, that when Obama talks about the duty that we have to our children, that this is not a problem for next generation, this is a problem right now, that resonates with people, and that is the kind of language that we need to be using all the time. When you point this out, particularly if you do so in the media, as I did this afternoon, talking about the plan, the response is, that's just not realistic. This system is not capable of that kind of change. And that's why my book is called This Changes Everything. because the truth is that when you start looking at this problem, at this challenge, you end up not just talking about emission reductions by, 32% by 2030 and this very technocratic discourse, this very bloodless language with which our policy experts talk about climate change. You end up talking about power. You end up talking about the outsized role that multinational corporations have in our economy, in our democracies. You end up talking about the fact how we're never going to get the things done that we need to get done until we get money out of politics, how our governments are broke, so we need to raise taxes on the wealthy, we need to cut spending on military, we need to do all these other things that don't usually fit into the climate basket. So I have friends in the environmental movement who have taken me aside since this book came out and said, Naomi, climate was big enough. Did you have to make it about capitalism? And I understand their point. But here's my argument. this economic system that we need to change if we're going to deal with climate change needs changing anyway. Now, if we were talking about an economic system that was working really, really well for the vast majority of people on this planet, except for the small matter of rising temperatures, we really would have, you know, an impossible problem on our hands, because you're not going to change a system that is working well for the majority of people if the only issue is a problem that seems far off. But actually, that's not the situation we're in right now. If you look around this country, what we see is emerging movements fighting for $15 an hour wages, for a living wage, because people are working incredibly hard and it doesn't pay them enough to live. We see an incredible civil rights movement in this country, standing up to institutionalized racism, saying Black Lives Matter, and standing up to the logic of putting profit and private property above all else. And around the world, we see that there is a huge and growing anger at the logic of what is called austerity. This is why there is a government in Greece that was elected to take on the European Central Bank and the German government and all of those prescribing attacks on wages, pensions, the public good in order to pay off the bankers. And now that movement has been told, well, your votes don't matter because we're going to ram this through anyway. And that is leading to even more of a backlash. So, you know, the argument I make in the book, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is that this is not about building a movement from scratch. It is really about connecting the dots between the movements that we already have. And instead of competing with one another and saying, you know, my issue is bigger than your issue, we'll deal with racism and poverty later after we fix the climate, because if we don't, you know, fix the climate, none of that matters, which frankly is something you hear sometimes from environmentalists, and it's incredibly damaging. Instead of that, it's that we have to get out of our issue silos and find the common themes that connect us. And I want to talk a little bit about some of those common themes, because, you know, we are in this moment where we are reaching a crisis point on so many issues: economic inequality, economic exclusion, institutionalized racism and police violence, and of course the climate crisis, which puts us on this firm science-based deadline and says, you know what, we have to turn this around by the end of the decade. That doesn't mean we have to do everything by the end of the decade, but by the end of the decade, the numbers need to be pointing in the right direction. Right now, they're pointing in the wrong direction. That's why we can't be doing things like opening up the Arctic to new oil drilling. So we are, and we're going to talk a little more about that in detail later. So the task is to come up with solutions that solve multiple problems at once, that lower emissions and reduce inequality and create jobs. And it's possible to do this. You know, Bill de Blasio announced on Earth Day this year a plan to build on Bloomberg's climate policies, but to bring to the table the task of reducing inequality. And his pledge, and it was quite an incredible pledge, we'll see whether he does it, is to move 800,000 people out of poverty in New York by 2030. That's as many people as live in San Francisco. And laid out the kinds of climate policies that would actually do that, like big investments in public transit. Because when you reduce commute times, you do the, you know, more than any other policy, you allow the most economically excluded people to have access to jobs. That's just one example. Targeting energy efficiency in low-income neighborhoods is another. But the point is that we can do all of the above, in that we can create jobs, we can reduce inequality, we can tackle institutionalized racism, and we can deal with the climate crisis at the same time. And nothing else but these sorts of triple or quadruple wins are going to get us where we need to go. And that's exactly how we're going to build this broad-based movement that we've talked about many, many times, and caught a glimpse of in New York City when 400,000 people marched in this historic climate march a year ago. Because that, what was so incredible about that march, beyond the fact that it was the biggest climate march anywhere in the world and that it was in the United States, which in and of itself was pretty remarkable, was that it looked and felt like New York City. It was definitely the most diverse environmental demonstration I've ever been to. And it was people who were really marching for their lives, marching for their water, marching for their air, marching for their future. And it was a knitting together of all of these frontline movements that had been fighting fracking, that had been fighting the Keystone XL pipeline, that had been closing down refineries in their backyards, and adding this other global layer, this global layer of climate change. But you know what that experience really left me with was an understanding that, you know, if we think about why we keep losing on climate, it's that we're up against forces that have a huge amount to lose if the people win on climate, right? I mean, when we talk about the fossil fuel divestment movement is based on this math that says that we need to keep around 3/4 of the proven fossil fuel reserves, the known fossil fuel reserves, not the stuff they haven't discovered yet in the Arctic, but the stuff they already know about and are already counting towards their reserves. We need to keep about 3/4 of that in the ground. That represents trillions of dollars. That's why the Koch brothers fight like they mean it. You know, if you had trillions of dollars on the line, you'd fight like hell too, right? On the other side of the equation, there's always been this sort of, I care about climate, but like, you know, after everything else, you know. I care about climate after I care about jobs, after I care about health, after I care about every other issue. And for too long, the strategy has been, well, then I'll just scare you more so you care more about climate now, right? When we unite our movements, when we unite the movement for economic justice and racial justice with climate justice, what we win is a movement that will fight as hard as the people we're up against. And so it isn't just like, though this is about being politically correct, it's also about winning. I don't think it is possible for a privileged, white, middle-class movement to win this fight. I think we win this fight when we really represent the people who have the most at stake. And I think it's absolutely critical that we spend as much time as we possibly can in the next month talking about what happened 10 years ago when Katrina made landfall in New Orleans. Because I don't think there is anything that will ever connect the dots more. I hope there is nothing that ever connects the dots more between Black Lives Matter, the fight for 15, the fight for economic justice, for good public schools, and climate change, than what happened in New Orleans during that hurricane and afterwards. And this, you know, those of you who are familiar with my book, The Shock Doctrine, I mean, New Orleans, this is what brought me to this issue, was covering Katrina. I mean, because New Orleans was ground zero of the shock doctrine. I have never seen a more naked, anti-democratic, just grab for anything and everything that our elites could get than what happened in New Orleans. And, you know, let's remember that that disaster was the result of a collision between heavy weather, which we know is linked to climate change, and we're going to see more intense hurricanes as ocean temperatures rise, and weak infrastructure, because by the time Katrina made landfall in New Orleans, it was no longer a Category 5 hurricane. It had been downgraded to a tropical storm. Those levees should have held, but they didn't hold because they had been systematically neglected like so much of our public sphere. This is why responding to climate change is not compatible with an austerity mindset. You have to invest in the public sphere to get off fossil fuels and also just to deal with the heavy weather that we've already locked in. And we saw that with Katrina. But then we also saw what happens when you hollow out the government. The government, you know, FEMA couldn't find New Orleans, it seemed, for 5 days. People, and you saw what it means to have such a highly unequal society, and and such privatized services. So if you had money, and in New Orleans that mostly meant if you were white, then you got into your car, you drove out of the city, you checked into a hotel, you called your insurance. If you depended on any level of government to get you out of there, you were completely out of luck. You were abandoned in the Superdome. You were abandoned on your rooftops holding signs that said help. And that wasn't the end of it, because then there was a systematic looting of the public sphere, despite the fact that this disaster was a result of the systematic neglect of the public sphere. There was a meeting in this city at the Heritage Foundation while New Orleans was still partially underwater 2 weeks after the storm hit, where a list was made, a wish list of solutions to Hurricane Katrina and high oil prices. And among them was privatize the education system, don't reopen the public hospitals, get rid of the public housing. And right now you can go to New Orleans and you can pretty much put a check mark next to every item on that list. Okay? So what happened in the aftermath of that disaster is that this economic agenda of corporate rule essentially took this leap forwards, backwards, depending on your perspective, precisely because people weren't around to defend their schools, to defend their homes, because they had been given one-way tickets out of there. That's what created the opportunity. The absence of people is what created the opportunity. So the opposite of populism, certainly the opposite of democracy. And after I published The Shock Doctrine, I did my first event for the book actually in New Orleans. And what people there wanted to talk about was, what's our disaster strategy? And I used to always quote, there's a labor organizer in New Orleans named Sackett Sony, who organized the migrant workers who had been brought in to New Orleans to do the reconstruction work on the cheap under abusive conditions, because this was a situation where there could have been higher local conditions, but that was one of the things on that list, was get rid of higher local provisions. And what Sackett said in that first meeting was, they have disaster capitalism, we need disaster collectivism. We need a way to respond to crisis that brings us together, where we actually get at the root causes of what is creating the crisis in the first place. So, you know, what I'm trying to do with this book is, you know, 7 years later, respond to that challenge. That it's not enough to just call out their disaster opportunism. There needs to be a vision, and a vision not just to reconstruct a system that was failing people before the disaster, but a vision for building a better economy now, one that will make us far less prone to all of these shocks and disasters. And we can do that. We can do that if we're willing to look at the reality of this crisis and act like it's a crisis, because that's this strange moment we're in right now, where we do have politicians like Obama who are saying all the right things, but there is such a chasm between these expressions of urgency and the level of action. If we had those in alignment the way we have in the past during times of war, after the Great Depression, I mean, there are moments in this country's history when we had social movements that demanded that governments act as if an emergency is an emergency. And one of the things we have to always remember is that our politicians aren't the only people who can declare an emergency. We can declare an emergency as well. And indeed, it is people declaring emergencies that is the only thing that has ever created real social change historically. And that is what is starting to happen. And it's starting to happen with the incredible direct action that we're starting to see, where the leadership that we should be seeing from our governments is coming from below, with people taking extraordinary risks. So I want to actually invite a friend of mine up to the mic, if that's okay. Annie Leonard, who I'm really happy is able to be here, who is the executive director of Greenpeace USA. And she has been leading her She has been leading the fight at Greenpeace. Well, Greenpeace has been leading the fight, and Annie's been leading Greenpeace. And you guys may know Annie from Story of Stuff, which is the incredible work she was doing before she was at Greenpeace. And we've all seen this amazing activism, the kayaktivism in Seattle and now Portland. I read a quote from Annie today responding to the energy plan. And what she said is that we need to see from our political leaders the kind of courage that we're seeing from people who are willing to take these types of risks. And I think that's exactly right. I also think that we should focus on the Arctic because I think we can win it, and winning's contagious. When you have infrastructure already in place, it's hard to roll it back when the money is already sunk. The point is that this isn't a done deal. We don't already have a massive infrastructure in place to drill for oil in the Arctic. We can still stop that. And there was Shell's earnings are down right now really significantly. There's been a little bit of patting ourselves on the back in the climate movement that we're hurting Shell's earnings. Maybe we can take some credit for it. But for me, I have to tell you, I get scared when these companies aren't as profitable as they are used to being, because that's when they get most dangerous. That's when they get most sloppy, right? I mean, if we think about what happened with BP, with Deepwater Horizon, and all of the forensics that was done after the fact, every single bad decision was because they were trying to cut costs. That's happening now. Shell has announced big layoffs. All the oil majors are looking at how they can cut costs. To be going into the Arctic in a cost-cutting environment, oh my God, that is such a bad idea. There was an interview with Shell's CEO where he was asked, well, is this really profitable with the price of oil down so low? And he reassured investors, saying this is not a short-term play. This is a long-term play. We're only going to be able to start production in 2030. But he said, we believe there is more oil in the Arctic than there is in the Gulf of Mexico. That's how huge this is. Do you understand how crazy it is to begin drilling a play that big in 2030 when we need to be winding down our fossil fuel infrastructure? And I think we need to focus on this because we can win it, because it is a very tangible, very real-world fight. But also, it's kind of the most unbelievable metaphor for the insanity of an economic system that can't think. All it can do is just look for that short-term growth, right? They're looking for new reserves to put on their balance sheets. And that's why I think it is worth focusing on the system, on that growth model that is preventing us from acting rationally. And there could be no better metaphor for this than Shell in the Arctic. So I'm going to leave it at that. We wanted to leave about half the time for questions, and we're at about the halfway mark. So let's hear from you.
Hi. Is Shell a Dutch company, or where is it from?
Yeah, they are. I mean, where is anyone from, really, these days? But yeah, they're still a Dutch company with American subsidiaries and Canadian subsidiaries and subsidiaries pretty much everywhere else. Yeah.
But their parent is in Holland, right?
Yes.
I have another silly question, but it relates to your compensation. Do you make the same off a Kindle sale as you do off a hard sale?
Oh, absolutely not.
What's the
Thanks
differential,
for asking.
Do you know?
Oh, the difference is huge, yes.
So I should buy the book and...
No, not necessarily. You should do whatever you want. You can steal it. No, don't steal it. I was going to say that in front of... I don't say that in front of the very few people who are still trying to keep authors alive.
Repeat the question so we can hear that.
Oh, yeah, I'll start doing that. Oh, the question was about, I think it was about whether authors make as much on hardcovers as they do on electronic books, on Kindle books. Yeah. And then the other question was whether Shell was a Dutch company. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. My name's Alice. Firstly, thank you so much. It was an honor to hear you. I was wondering, there's an argument that solar panels can't power schools and manufacturing and hospitals. So given that, I was wondering what you think the role is for renewable energies in developing countries, or non-renewable energies, I suppose.
So I don't know where that comes from. The question was that there's an argument that renewables can't power schools and hospitals, and given that, what is the role of renewables in developing countries? Look, renewables are getting, the technology is getting better every day. And in particular, I think what you're referring to is the storage capacity, because the power is there. I mean, right now in Germany, on hot, sunny days in Germany, they're getting upwards of 70% of their electricity from renewables. On average, they're getting 30% of their energy from renewables. But it is powering factories, it's powering schools, it's powering hospitals, but you need backups. The best technology has renewables compensating for other renewables. So, I mean, the nice thing about wind and sun is that they're really, their solar powers, that they're really complementary, in that it tends to be windier when the sun goes down, so that wind can pick up when there is less sun, but also the storage capacity is getting better. And what's becoming clear in countries like Bangladesh right now is that if the support is there for renewables, it's actually a much better way to get power to the poor than building these hulking coal-fired power plants that take land away from the poor, pollute their water, which is why you have huge movements against coal-fired power plants in India, in China. I mean, look at what's happening in China with air pollution, where you know, it's at such crisis levels that you have epidemic levels of asthma and cancer for very, very young children, kids going to school in pollution masks. So there's a real grassroots movement in the global south rejecting coal and demanding decentralized renewable. The thing about renewables is that because the wind and sun are everywhere and free, it's a system that if you have that upfront investment, and there is an upfront investment, then you don't have to replicate this extremely centralized energy system that we have here in our country and in so many countries, where if you're digging carbon out of the ground, you need that hulking infrastructure to dig it up, to transport it, to refine it, whereas renewables are just a lot lighter, and so you can have a much more decentralized economic model fueling it. Sure, yeah. So is it possible? I mean, it is happening. So the question is it possible to roll it out in countries that don't have it? And, you know, I mentioned Bangladesh because that's a country that is rolling out decentralized renewable very quickly. It's also happening in India. It's happening in China. It's just in China, both, it's such a huge country, such a huge economy, that it's one of those, like, taking, you know, a big step in the right direction, big step in the wrong direction at the same time, and they're kind of canceling each other out in China. But the scale of solar in China is stunning. I mean, China is spending more on clean energy technology than the entire European Union. So it is happening, but for very poor countries, unlike India and China that, you know, are able to do this, the government is able to do this, but, you know, say a country like Bolivia, which is extremely vulnerable to climate change because it's a country that's dependent on glaciers for its fresh water, they're going to need support from wealthier countries in order to leapfrog over fossil fuels. And if they don't get that support, they're going to raise the revenue by digging up fossil fuels. And so that's why when you follow climate negotiations, a huge piece of the puzzle is what's called climate financing. That's the jargon. Climate financing means recognizing that we cannot do this on our own, that we need a global strategy, and that means the people who have been burning fossil fuels for a couple of hundred years and really created this crisis owe a debt to poorer countries like Bolivia, and that we need to provide the technology and also provide the money so that they can leapfrog over fossil fuels and go straight to renewables. It is possible, but you know, frankly, it's become a lot harder since the economic crisis in 2008, where like even just talking about aid in this country is sort of like, well, we don't talk about that anymore because you know we're only focused on ourselves. And you know, this is once again why you know I called the book what I did call it, is that you know the thing that is so sticky and troubling about climate change is that ultimately we are not going to solve this problem within our current paradigms. Like if we only see other countries as being some places we are competing with, then we won't get there. Like we actually have to have a sense of global solidarity because it requires, it demands this kind of cooperation.
So thank you so much. It was really great to hear you speak. And I have a question that I think is kind of related to that issue. I'm curious about, in hearing you speak about the relationship between economic issues and structural racism and things like that, I'm curious to hear your perspective on the relationship between post-conflict work and peace-building and the environment. I'm thinking about people who are displaced in conflict, and in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, they talk about the importance of the right to land and the return to the land, but we don't talk about the quality of the land in that, and I'm curious to hear insights on the way we can infuse environmental sustainability issues into post-conflict work.
Well, that is a great question that I'm not sure I have a great answer for. to repeat that question, it was about the connection between responding to climate change and post-conflict work, which is often about the right of people to return to land. And, you know, what does that mean, you know, if the land has been changed so much, right? I mean, that's the way I read the question. And I've seen some very direct examples of this. There's a documentary film that is accompanying this book that's coming out in September. It's also called This Changes Everything. And one of the communities that that we followed in the filming is a community in El Salvador that is a post-conflict community, a group of people that returned from exile after the civil war in El Salvador and came to a piece of land that was supposed to sustain them, but then it has been flooding and flooding and flooding repeatedly. So this intersection around the right to land, the right to return to one's land, and whether or not that land exists or exists in a form that can sustain people, or whether it is so changed that it's no longer essentially the same land, is, you know, the reason why, frankly, climate change is a human rights issue. It is a moral crisis. Earlier it was mentioned that I had done some work with the Vatican. I'm not actually a consultant with the Vatican. The right sort of freaked out when I was invited to the Vatican to speak. And every time, every article just kept inflating my role. Like pretty soon I was like co-pope. I'm like the first Jewish secular feminist pope, actually. I'm just announcing this for you guys here tonight. But I think what is so significant, and the reason why I accepted the invitation, despite the fact that I disagree with the Vatican on let me count the ways, you know, reproductive freedom, gay marriage, IVF, abortion. Okay, we can go on. But I think what is happening with Pope Francis is that this crisis, which is so deeply a moral crisis, and yet is discussed in this very bloodless language, and you know, even the articles about that came out today about the emission reductions, it's like makes your eyes roll back in your head. Okay, so it's 32%, not 30%, but it's 32% emission reduction. But from 2005 benchmark, not 1990 benchmark, which is what it's supposed to be under the Kyoto Protocol, and normal people are just dying right now, you know. And even people who follow this or go, what does this even mean, right? But I remember this moment when I was in Copenhagen for that big climate conference, and there was a session on climate refugees. And there was a speaker from an island nation who was talking about whether there was going to be a change to the International Declaration on the Rights of Refugees to recognize the rights of climate refugees, and whether or not his people were going to be allowed to relocate as a coherent community, so that it wouldn't just be that you would open the doors to people who had lost their country, but whether they would be able to move to a part of New Zealand where they would all live together, right? And the only word that I could think of in this moment was genocide. Like, that is what it means to knowingly destroy a culture, right? And if you say that to a climate negotiator from a wealthy country, they go, no, because genocide means that I want to erase you. Really, I just don't care if I erase you. So we need a new word for a crime that involves erasing a people out of indifference, not malice. If you are on the receiving end, do you care whether it's indifference or malice? Frankly, I don't believe we have the language, let alone the laws, to deal with what we are creating here. And that is why I think it is so tremendously significant that the encyclical injects the language of morality into this discussion. And I think it will be, or should be, transformative when Francis comes to this city and to New York and Philadelphia in September. But we really need to make the most of it.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for coming. I have a question that kind of arose in my own mind a few weeks back. You mentioned fracking briefly earlier, so I really just wanted to get your take on the EPA report, I guess, that was released several weeks ago that seemed to, absolve some of the accusations and the responsibilities that people associate to fracking. And I was kind of surprised by it because I'm skeptical of the practice as well, I guess, kind of opposed to it, so... It was interesting findings, and I didn't get a chance to look into it myself, so I'm curious to hear your take.
So, it is worth looking at it, or just doing a little bit of digging around it, because there's been a huge controversy about the way the findings were reported, even by the EPA itself, in that there was a press release that essentially misrepresented the findings of the actual study, and that's what's come out since. So, the problem with the news cycle is, what happens in that first day when the news comes out? EPA says fracking's great, moving right along. And then the next day, they're like, well, actually, no, that's not what it found. It found multiple instances where there was water contamination. But by then, the story has moved on. So that's actually not what that study found.
Hi, thank you so much for all your work on all of this. So, of course, there's an election season gearing up, which in an optimistic world would present an opportunity for us. And there was actually an article today reacting to President Obama's Clean Power Plan release saying that, well, this means that the presidential candidates will have to respond and discuss climate change seriously. But as you noted, we're talking still about small steps, not transformational steps. So one would expect that their responses will be in the small steps arena. So what can we all do to convince all of the candidates that climate and the related issues are really major issues for constituents, and they're not just, small steps, and that responding to President Obama's legacy needs to be a really high-profile, concerted effort?
Mm-hmm. I think that there is progress that we can see quite clearly. So the question is during the election campaign, how can people really keep the pressure up on climate and show that this is an issue of major concern, that people want serious action? Is that fair enough? Okay, cool. I think, first of all, the fact that it is as much of an issue as it is something that movements should feel very good about. That this is a reflection of the fact that there's been a change in strategy. This did not come up in the last electoral cycle. It's already being talked about more, and it hasn't even officially started, right? Than it did in the last electoral cycle. And that is because so many people have made it clear that this is a huge priority for them. We heard about some of it from Annie. I think a big piece of this also is the fossil fuel divestment movement. And the fossil fuel divestment movement is a science-based movement. It starts with the numbers, right? It starts with, you know, doing the math, as Bill McKibben said in that Rolling Stone article that everybody read, that there is this gap between what we need to do to stay below 2 degrees and what the fossil fuel companies are planning on doing according to their own fossil fuel reserves. There's 5 times more carbon in their reserves. And so I think every time that people make that argument for why we need to divest, at their universities, within their faith organizations, in their trade unions, talking about their pensions, they are talking about the science that we need our politicians to discuss. And I also think that the next phase for fossil fuel divestment has to be about the fact that if these profits are so illegitimate that we don't want Georgetown University to have anything to do with them, then they also are so illegitimate that the public has a right to those profits in order to pay for the transition away from fossil fuels. And we have one of the leaders of the fossil fuel divestment movement who actually was talking about this way before Bill McKibben and me and 350.org, and that's Ellen Dorsey, who is the director of Wallace Global Foundation and has led the move in the foundation world to divest from fossil fuels, and they even got the Rockefeller family to divest. So I'm going to also take advantage of the fact that Ellen's here. Can I invite you up to say a few words about where this is at? Okay, just a couple, as many as you want. Yay, Ellen.
First of all, Naomi has played an incredible role in conceptualizing and supporting this movement. So her hands are all over it. Let me just say a couple of quick things. First of all, my foundation has been involved in funding the movement, as well as we've divested from fossil fuels and invested over 10% of our assets in climate solutions. I want you to think about this. How can a foundation invest in companies with the 95% of its assets that with the 5% it's asking grantees to solve the problems the companies are creating? It too is an insanity. And that we all have to focus on what we own. And if we own fossil fuels, we own climate change. That's true with Catholic University, that's true with Georgetown University, that's true with your state pension funds, that's true with your retirement account, and that's true with your faith institutions' investments. And I would say that not only should faith institutions and foundations and universities divest, but imagine if the Vatican put 5% of its investments in energy access for the world's majority and got solar ubiquitously distributed throughout the world. We can all play a role in this energy transition. And I think that's what this movement is ultimately about. It's building people power to move institutions with influence, and it's targeting the right actor. The industry itself that has spent literally tens of millions of its profits on denying the science, preventing regulation at any level, globally, nationally, at the state level, at the sub-state level. It's bought off politicians. And we used to bus people down to Washington to lobby for public policy du jour, which would fail. And if it passed, we wouldn't want it because it would be so deeply compromised. It's time to expose the failures of the business model of this industry that leads to insanity like the Arctic. So we're building people power, and it's a people power that can't believe that Paris is going to solve the problem. There will be an international agreement in December. There's no doubt. And some good things might come out of it, but it's fundamentally not going to change the system that Naomi is talking about. And the worst thing that would happen is that this new fantastic global climate justice movement would demobilize after Paris. We cannot let that happen. Because after Paris, not only do we have to hold the governments accountable to whatever they agree to, but we have to continue the pressure on divestment. We have to continue pressure for investment. Governments can't invest the money that will make a just transition, a new energy economy occur. But we also have to stop fossil fuels everywhere. We have to stop the Arctic. We have to stop the subsidies. We have to stop the campaign contributions. So stay fired up. Stay mobilized. Use your pressure at the institutions where you have influence, your faith group, your university, your city, your own retirement account, and we're making progress. 5 years ago, it felt apocalyptic. It doesn't now. It feels like we really do have people power. So thank you, Naomi, and thank you, Annie, because it's so inspiring to see two really powerful women doing amazing stuff.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you, Ellen.
Hello, and let me thank you for coming, and more than anything, for everything that you do. I wonder if I could bring you back to talk about social movement politics more broadly. It seems to me that what you're talking about in terms of movements that are siloed is kind of the classic dilemma of the left.
Yes.
Right? It's the classic dilemma of progressive politics. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit more about how you envision moving from silo politics to one big tent and what all of us here can do to move towards that one big tent politics.
Thank you. Okay, so that was a question about social movements and this really challenging task of getting out of our silos and building a social movement, which is something that people in a lot of countries understand and that we in North America are really bad at. And speaking of foundations, I love Ellen, and her foundation is amazing. And one of the things they're amazing for is the fact that they encourage people to get out of their silos. That is so rare. It is a huge problem. Particularly in this country, that you know, the reason people stay, you know, with their issues is not because they don't see the connections between, you know, defunding the public schools that are overwhelmingly serving communities of color and police violence in those same communities, and the need for green jobs and all kinds of good jobs and attacks on public health care. People understand that this is all part of the same project, but there's a funding structure that encourages people to just work on campaigns as opposed to building movements that is very afraid of actually talking about systems. The right does not have this problem. The Koch brothers are having their big convening right now. They have invested massively in ideas, in shifting the culture. That's what all these huge think tanks in this city are all about. It started big time in the 1960s, when you know there were some few think tanks before that, but that was when there was the counterculture was shifting the discourse pretty radically to the left, and the elites panicked and they said, "Boy, we need to take ideas seriously." And that whole think tank infrastructure—the reason why the right is always ready in a disaster—is because all of these think tanks are incubators for policy and for ideas, so that whenever the disaster hits, they're ready to come in with the same policies. We don't have that for progressive movements. So we need different funding models, because I frankly don't think it's going to be the foundations that are going to fund this. We need different funding models where we understand and invest in the importance of shifting hearts and minds, of shifting the underlying values that have moved so far towards hyper-individualism. When Charles Koch announced that they were going to be marshaling around $1 billion in the next presidential, in this presidential election cycle, he said that what that money was for was holding back the march of collectivism. the march of the many, right? That's their meta frame for everything they do, whether it's fighting climate policy or fighting healthcare or rolling back Social Security or attacking labor rights. They are standing up for the individual against the many, okay? So what is our meta frame? What is our big idea? And the truth is, it's not hard to find big ideas that unite our movements, but I actually think we need to be honest that we are dealing with the legacy of McCarthyism, blacklisting, the attacks on the Black Power movement that have made people afraid of ideas and more comfortable focusing on symptoms. And so, you know, we need to admit that so that we can rebuild from that, right? Because this is actually, I actually think that the left in the United States is traumatized by these attacks. So that's just my little aside. I'm Canadian. I'm actually American too. My parents moved to Canada during the Vietnam War. I don't tell that to everybody. I've been part of a group in Canada that has been trying to do exactly this, get people out of their silos, bring people together. And what we have heard from social movements is that everybody understands we need to get out of our silos, but there's a sort of atmosphere of scarcity and competition, and if one of the groups, if it's convened by the green groups, then immediately labor's on the defensive. If it's convened by labor, immediately the greens are on the defensive. So the little group that I have working with me on this book and documentary film and this, we call it outreach. My colleague Katie McKenna, who heads up the outreach, is here. I mean, it's not outreach, it's movement building, right? Because we understand that books don't change the world, films don't change the world, movements change the world, and we need to work together to do that. And so what Katie did, all of this outreach with social movements, and she said, would it be useful for us to host something? And everybody said, please do it, because basically we're not threatened by you because you don't really exist. You know, because we're not really a thing, right? And we're like a pop-up. We're like one of those pop-up things, right, Katie? So Katie pulled together this two-day meeting, and we've had, you know, we had a convening in Oakland, we had a convening in New York around the People's Climate March, and then there was a group in the UK that pulled together 1,000 people, called it This Changes Everything. They brought together labor, migrant rights, racial justice activists, food activists, and just sort of brainstormed for a whole day about what Katie's talking about, just sort of dreaming together, not what are the defensive fights, but what would it actually look like? Yes, of course, we want 100% renewables, but that's not good enough if the same people putting, you know, if Shell owns all the solar panels. We want the transition to renewable energy to also be a moment where we build more just economies, where we make sure that the people who are getting the worst deal in this economy, who are the frontline communities, are first in line to own and control the energy generation of the next economy. And so all kinds of ideas like that. And what we did in Canada is we actually we've drafted a manifesto that we're calling the Leap Manifesto, and we did it because, frankly, in Canada you can get people together in a room. Like to draft this, we had the executive director of Greenpeace Canada, and we had the representatives from the trade union that represents the workers in the Alberta oil sands. That's not something that happens in this country, but we actually hashed it out, and Indigenous rights leaders and so on, and the head of our labor federation, the equivalent of the AFL-CIO in Canada. So people are willing to come together and do this. And what's interesting is that people in this country told us this would be useful for us because it's always hard to start from a blank sheet of paper. So we'll be launching this in September. People can have a look at it. I actually think it's totally critical for this country and everywhere in the lead up to Paris for us to really see this momentum towards this next big UN climate conference, which is, you know, we're going to hear more and more talk about climate between now and December in the same way that we heard a lot before Copenhagen. But we can't repeat, as Ellen said, that trajectory of, you know, putting all of our hopes on this sort of messianic leaders and then just going, you know, into deep depression. There's actually a psychoanalyst in England who has coined the phrase Copenhagen syndrome to describe the depression that spread through the environmental movement after Copenhagen. She diagnosed it. We don't want a Paris syndrome, okay? So we need to go into this with our eyes open and really just see this as a huge platform, a huge megaphone for our movements to come together across, out of our silos, and articulate what it would mean to leap to the next economy. And I use the phrase leap because we're constantly hearing about things, how things are steps in the right direction. And we've waited too long for steps in the right direction. And when there are too many problems for us to just have a step in the right direction for one issue and then steps backwards for other issues that are equally important. So that's why we need this holistic, coherent leap forward. And I actually thought about calling the book The Leap. That, you know, I played with a lot of different titles. And because I really like this idea of sort of punctuated change, because I really do think that this is how change happens. If we think about, you know, the moments of the New Deal, you know, when we actually make progress, a lot of things happen simultaneously. And I think that that's, you know, we're so sort of married to this idea of, no, we just need to ask for small things one after another after another. That's actually not the way change happens. So it turns out that the next leap year is next year, is 2016. And so I started reading up about leap years, and I became really interested in it because, you know, what is a leap year? A leap year is, you know, every 4 years we add a day to our human-created calendar because it actually does not adhere to the Earth's rotation around the sun. And if we don't, then our whole calendar will fall out of balance with the season. So we have to add this year as a balancing. And historically, there have been, you know, leap years have been times when you know, strange things happen, like women were allowed to propose to men in Victorian England, but just on leap day. So if we're thinking about what our strategy is after this predictable disappointment in Paris, I think it would be great if wherever we live, we got ready for the leap, which means getting together in rooms like this, not having somebody at the front talking into a mic. You know, we didn't have any speeches at our meetings, and really thinking together and dreaming together, and then leaping together. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Naomi. Thank you for coming.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.